Hi everyone, this is Chris Deasy and welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Christine Acheson. Christine lives in the suburbs of Toronto and I first met Christine at the end of 2020 when I was the examiner on her PhD exploring transcendence in film. We talk about how the journey started with the 1989 Tim Burton Batman movie and also a conversation in a bar on pluralism in the patristic period. We talk about imposter syndrome and Iliada, studying in the UK, moving to China, watching superhero movies in China, seeing how they are received there compared to the West. We talk about the future of cinema post-lockdown. We talk about her experience of watching Batman versus Superman and how it was a very different experience from that of her friends. She talks about how she studied biology and history at university, how she got into religious studies, her working class background, the different path that she followed to other family members. She talks about the privilege element of doing a PhD and how university changed her life forever. And we talk about the teachers who have been so supportive to Christine over the years. Towards the end of the interview, Christine discusses how even the negative things don't always feel negative and how she can be nostalgic about those fragile moments. We talk about depth and transcendence, how her younger self would be confused about what she is doing now. We discuss whether we would want to revisit the past, and at the very end we discover why Christine is neither a looking back nor a looking forward kind of person. It was such a pleasure to catch up with Christine Acheson in Toronto for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Christine Acheson as my latest guest and the second nostalgia interviewee in just a short space of time from Canada. And we were just saying, weren't we, Christine, before you started that you're based fairly near Toronto?
Yeah, about 45 minutes from Toronto in a suburb, yeah.
Yeah, and of course we met a few months ago in a far more sort of formal environment in your PhD Viva, and I have to say it was obviously such a pleasure to read your work because it obviously intersects with my own interests. But do you want to say a little bit just about the kind of interest that you have been working on over the last few years?
Yeah, I've been exploring transcendence in film and then comic books using existing models that people like some of you interviewed recently, John Lydon, have outlined, and sort of yourself with your own work on redemption in film, and working on that and figuring out how that applies to superhero narratives, and then exploring what impact the medium has on the transcendent potential, as I called it, of superhero narratives in film and comic books.
Yeah, and for me, I remember is when I was doing my own PhD in the late 90s, and actually it was a piece that we were talking about in the Viva by Bruce David Forbes, and it was to have a religious studies professor talking about Batman and crucifixion in the same title, and that sort of got me very interested because I think my degree was in theology, and I loved doing it, but it was very classic. You know, we didn't look at popular culture, and actually that's not a bad thing, and in a way that was the exciting bit for later. It was like, you know, you've got the ground rules and then it's what you do with it afterwards. But then suddenly it was like a completely new direction, and that there were areas of research that up to that point seemed to be, you know, compartmentalized in entertainment, or the sort of thing that as a student, you know, I might do on a Sunday night. I was in a very sort of remote university where we didn't have a cinema, but they put on a screening for us, sort of a makeshift cinema on a Sunday night in the university arts hall, and that's where we'd watch Batman and The Rocketeer. Actually, I think was one of the very first ones I saw in my first year at university with Timothy Dalton. Yeah. So how did your interest in superheroes and comics come about?
Fractured. When I was really little, I read comics, mostly like Fantastic Four and X-Men and Spider-Man. But then when I got old enough, so to date myself, I was born in the very late 80s, almost the 90s. But when I got old enough, my dad let me watch the 1989 Batman, which in retrospect, he probably should have waited till I was a little bit older. I think I watched when I was like six. But I just Loved it. And I know, and then I watched all the Batmans after, including like Batman Forever, which when I was like 10 or 11, I just thought it was great. I like Chris O'Donnell. So, but then now I look back, I'm like, oh, it's not that good. But, I just really liked it. And then I stopped reading comics. I don't remember why. I just did stop reading comics. And then during my undergrad, I worked at this call center for like roadside assistance. And the great thing about working there was we had these metrics where like every call had to be answered really quickly because people were calling in an emergency situation, which meant it was never that busy. There was always like quite a bit of time between calls because we couldn't have everybody busy and miss an emergency call. And so it meant there was a lot of downtime and everybody working there was around my age and a lot of them were into comics. And so I just started reading comics more and more and more, and I got really into them again. And then during my master's, I was researching like a very sort of highbrow topic, and I was at a bar with this other professor, and he's like, you know, all you ever do is talk about comics, why don't you research comics? And I was like, oh, am I able to do that? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, who would supervise me? He's like, I don't know, that's kind of it's kind of your thing, but I'll help you. And then he did, and then it was from there. So it was sort of a windy road, I guess.
Yeah. And it's interesting in terms of the way that the education system, certainly in the UK, moves on, because, you know, when we were at school, I mean, and this is one of the questions I'll come to a bit later, but, you know, it was in the playground, we'd all be talking about the things we watched on TV, all the charts and the stuff, the music that we listened to. But school was always very sort of more serious. And actually, that's good, because, you know, you need the basics and get all that. And the way it was taught was very much, you know, let's learn how to do fractions, or let's learn, you know, grammar. And that's very, very important. But education in that sense always seemed to be something that was kind of like we did it because we had to rather than because we wanted to, and there was no enjoyment element in it. It's only in later years, certainly when I was at school, that you suddenly realized that you could flourish, and actually education was a means to emancipate, and it was sort of really did elevate the mind. It always felt about conformity and citizenship when I was very young, and that I think it was also the teachers and the school ethos being one very much of, you know, you must know what the rules are, how to behave, you must conform. And if everyone knows what the rules are, then after that, you can all sort of not so much let your guard down, but you can certainly start to unpack whatever it is that you're studying. And it was only really for me at university that suddenly all these doors opened, and particularly for me in the PhD, that's exactly what, you know, because obviously the area of my PhD is very, very close to what you were doing in your own. And I think that is very important. And I think it's very interesting to go back on those younger days and work out exactly what you ever imagined you could possibly do with, for example, a university degree, let alone a doctorate.
Yeah, I had no plans to get a doctorate. It just sort of happened, but all because of that conversation at a bar. Like I was what was I researching? I was researching pluralism in the patristic period, which is very interesting, and I think people should research that. But it's, you know, it's just so different from what I ended up researching, where I was just like, huh. It's just like I just switched gears really quickly after that bar conversation when I realized I was allowed to really research whatever I wanted instead of I thought I needed like a highbrow topic because I was at a highbrow university, and so I was like, and I was in this program and there were only 8 of us, and that's like the maximum amount of people they allowed in the program, and it was like difficult to get into, and there were all these things where I knew that something crazy, like 96% of people who got their master's from that program who applied to do PhDs were successful. And so I thought that in order to, I had like crazy imposter syndrome because in one of my first classes, somebody mentioned like Iliadi. I like didn't know who Iliadi was. And so I was like, oh, who's Iliadi? And everybody just like stared at me. And I was like, I need a highbrow topic. And so I was like overcompensating, and then having drinks with a professor who just said I could study what I wanted was just so freeing. And I was like, oh, that's great. And so I was so happy.
But it can work the other way, of course, because sometimes somebody might have some really good ideas, but then they start to panic. And then, of course, you end up doing a PhD that may not be what you originally set out to do. And I know plenty of people who've ended up doing something that, you know, was never perhaps what they really thought that they would do, but it was more that they were perhaps playing it safe. And I think that sometimes if it's well structured and you know exactly what you want to do and you really believe in it, then it sounds like a superhero sort of trope, doesn't it? You know, it will come. You know, if you believe in it, it will come. Field of Dreams as a PhD, but it can work. But also, I think certainly in my case, I was very much drawing on aspects of Christology and ideas about the person of Christ and redemption. And so it was almost as though for every sort of time I referred to a film, I was aware that I was drawing on really good scholarship in theology and related disciplines. So that even if it was just in my mind, if the charge came up, or you know, does this have enough academic weight, then I'd be able to counter that charge. But I think that was largely going on in my head. I don't think, but it was just more that it was a good spur to me to move on, and that I think is actually always good advice to heed.
It was really interesting, actually, because I didn't change like my theoretical method when I changed topics, because when I was looking at pluralism in the patristic period, I was taking like contemporary theories of pluralism, and I was not like applying them to ancient history or text, because that's irresponsible, but I was looking at like the ancient historical context of the patristic period through that lens to try to say, you know, actually it's a lot more pluralistic than people tend to, not scholars but undergrads anyway, tend to paint it with like a brush of, oh, this was like the birth of the early Christian church, which itself was like an exercise in pluralism anyway within Jews. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. But so I was looking at it through these like modern theorists of like Hick and a lot of John Hick for pluralism. And then I was also using these like hermeneuticists to analyze texts. And then when I switched to comics, I just looked at pluralism in like Green Lantern, and I still use like hermeneutic texts and pluralism. So it was, so I still wanted to keep some of the highbrow things, because I think like you, I was just like, I might have to defend this, like this choice.
But also, it also gives you a certain compartmentalization, because you've got the PhD, which follows a certain sort of set of rules. Mm-hmm. But also outside of that, what you do with those texts, with those films, with those, you know, the comics is kind of your thing. It's applying what you know from the comics and the films with the theory. So as long as you kind of know where the boundaries are, then you can push yourself in lots of different ways. In other words, you can really indulge in a comic, and you can do that for pure pleasure and use it for your academic work, but you know exactly what sort of the contours are. And it's kind of wearing different hats, but it's also means that you've got a lot more to draw on, and you become very quickly an authority in these areas. In fact, you know, I always think about a PhD is that by the time the student has finished it, they are the expert in that field. And even the supervisor, who's obviously guiding them along the journey in many ways, will know less about the subject than the PhD student because of the area of specialism. So in that sense, it's a very gratifying experience, much more so in some ways than any degrees before it, when you're often doing up there with, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 other people who all went to the same classes as you, and in many cases wrote the same assignments.
Yeah, it is a very different experience, and my supervisor Will was he was really deliberate about that transition. Like, I remember when I had the literature review done and the method done and like one decent case study, he was like, we're getting to the point now where you should start to become a little bit more expert than I am. And he deliberately kind of changed the way he interacted with me. And so he was really good at making that not feel foreign and reducing like imposter syndrome, which I'm really grateful for. And Kathy also from the beginning prepared. So both Kathy and Will were really like, it felt like a natural thing, but still a little bit surreal, where I was like, oh, like, I guess I am the expert, maybe. And so it's still, yeah, it's an interesting transition during that time, eh?
And it also means that in some ways, perhaps perversely, when it comes to things like a PhD viva, it can be quite a pleasant experience, because you, if you know the stuff as well as you do, then you will, as obviously happened in your case, but you know, you're able to flourish. Because how many other times have you found yourself, you know, dying to have the sort of conversations, but which you just can't do because, of course, the limited, only of a limited number of people who are perhaps going to be privy to what you're doing in the PhD. Or, as I've often found, it can be far easier when you're in a room of people who expect you and want you to enable you to talk about your thesis than if you're on the bus or at the supermarket checkout, where people say, "So what are you doing then?" And sometimes, of course, then the look on their face is like, you know, "Why are you doing that? Why are you wasting your time? Or what's the point? Or what's your purpose? Or you're doing something on religion, so what's your motivation?" And then the conversation goes off in directions that you almost feel that you're watching every single word, which you don't do in the same way. You don't need to in the same way when you're in a community of like-minded academics.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is probably not a great character trait of mine, but I think partway through I just stopped caring what other people thought about it. And so I stopped watching my words about halfway through, and they'd be like, "Oh, are you going to be a pastor?" And I'm like, "No." And they're just like, "Then why?" Because knowledge is important regardless what it's about. "Oh, but I don't really get it." That's fine. Like, you don't need to. It's okay. Like, and I just like stopped caring, but then I still didn't get to talk to many people about it. So it was actually like, I really enjoyed the Viva, which I'm really grateful for, because it was genuinely kind of fun, precisely because of what you said. Like, for 2 hours, I just got to talk to people about my work without teaching people about my work. Like, you've already read it, and I used yours in it. It kind of reminded me of those days, like during my master's, when I would be with like my peers and we were talking about what topics we were going to pick for our thesis and things like that. And it felt, not that you're my peer, but it just felt very natural. And it was precisely because of what you said, which is, I get to talk to somebody who knows a lot about it. And it was just really nice. Yeah.
No, that's kind of you. Although, of course, now that you are Dr. Christine Atchison, I think this is most certainly peer to peer. So I think that, and you know, the work that you did, I thought was brilliant. And we'll obviously come back to a lot of this in a minute, but I was going to ask you just clarification, because of course, although you're in Canada, you did the PhD in the UK. And I think, am I right in thinking that you spent a lot of time in the UK and then returned to Canada to finish?
Yeah. So I was in the UK, and I'm from like a fairly working class family, and so it was expensive to live around London. And then during my PhD, I don't know if you recall this, but England changed the rules around tier four student visas for like how much you could work. And so it really put a bind. Like, I had some funding, which was good, because of Cinema Journal. But living around London, Kingston is expensive. So I was like, "Oh, like, what am I going to do?" So I went to take like a year off. And I thought, well, if I'm going to take a year off, I want it to be like a productive year off. And so, and Will and Kathy were quite kind. They're like, "Even though you're like a year off, we're still going to like supervise you unofficially, like whilst you're off." And I was like, okay. And so I moved to China because I thought, superhero films, like China, they only have so many films a year, Western films a year that they show. Like, I think it's 8 maybe. And often a couple of those are superhero films. And when you watch superhero films and how they interact with like different, how superheroes interact with different countries and things, you can start seeing that China's becoming a bigger market for like consuming superhero films. And the filmmakers are very cognizant of that. And so being aware of that, I was like, I'm going to move to China and make some money, and whilst there, just watch superhero films in China, and also get to know this whole other culture. Because like, although I had lived in multiple countries, I had never experienced a non-democratic country. I'd never experienced long-term apart from vacations like an Eastern country, and it was important to me to do that. And so the intention was to move there, work for a year, save up money, and then come back and finish, because I only had like a year or two left to finish. So I was like, I can be frugal, I can save money. And then about 9 months into China, I injured myself like pretty severely. And so then I had to return home, like emergency. It was a big thing. And what happened was I needed to do like almost a year of like intense physio and massage and doctor guided, like all this therapy stuff to like be physically able to like do things again. And then that put me behind, and I was like, oh man, how am I ever going to finish this PhD? And so then Will and Kathy were amazing. They like advocated for me with Kingston University. And I don't know if Kingston University had done this before, but they got me to be like a part-time distance-based student. So I only had to pay local fees, even though I was an international student, because I wasn't using like any physical resources. And I only had to pay like part-time fees. And so they did this whole thing to like make it possible for me to finish, which I'm so like, without them, I wouldn't have finished. So I'm like eternally grateful. And so then I just got a full-time job. And then I just did my PhD part-time from here with their help. And it all worked out in the end. I met my husband. It's all good. But it was like a weird, windy road. Mm. Something that was supposed to be 3 to 4 years, I think, took like 7 or 8. And I was like, oh, man. Wow. I wanted a PhD by 27, and now I'm like 33. And I'm like, oh, dear. It worked out really well. It was all positive in the end. But, it was an interesting, weird thing for why I'm like in Canada doing this part-time distance-based PhD.
It sounds terrible. It sounds like on the one hand, you had some amazing experiences in China, coupled with that, then something completely unexpected, which obviously resulted in you completely having to press that reset button. But did you, when you were in China, mm-hmm. Were you watching films were they dubbed? Were you watching them through the medium of Chinese?
Once I watched one in Chinese, most of the time I watch them in English, because sometimes they would just have, like in cinemas, the films in English with like Chinese subtitles, and sometimes they would have it in Chinese with like English subtitles. But then I rewatched the films when I came, like North American versions, and there were some minor changes, but I would rewatch them when I came back to Canada, because sometimes it's hard to get certain bits of media in China. It's a little bit controlled, unless you go through back channels, and then it's just risky. So that's what I did. Yeah, I watched some in Chinese, I watched some in English, but I tried to watch them in cinemas, like with Chinese people, because of what like Clive Marsh said about, you know, the cinematic experience. And I was like, I think it's important for me to watch this like in a cinema. And so it was, yeah, it was interesting. It was different. I liked it.
Yeah, I think cinema is incredibly important. Although since the cinemas closed during lockdown, I've been forced to watch a lot of films, albeit in high definition, and in many cases watching them with a much clearer picture and more sort of pristine print than would have been the case even at the cinema. But watching them on Blu-ray in many cases, or some of the streaming channels, and that's interesting, because when Clive Marsh wrote that piece, you're right, it was sort of, the assumption was, even in 2004, the tacit assumption was, if you want to go and see a film, you go to the cinema, and even until lockdown, I was going to the cinema regularly to watch films. But of course, that's oxygen, if you like, has been taken away from me. And I'm curious as to what's going to happen, especially in the light of films. I mean, I didn't get to see the Wonder Woman film, for example, the Wonder Woman 1984, because that was released in the UK, but it like came out on the Friday, and then literally 24, 48 hours later, many parts of the country were put into lockdown, and no cinemas could open, and they couldn't open in Kent anyway, so there was no chance of me watching it at all. So a lot of my friends have seen it, and even one or two of them have said, oh, are you going to write a review of it? And I said, but, you know, I want to see it at the cinema. But it's interesting, isn't it, how, as you say, there's this almost like this excitement, this need to watch it around other people, to do it in a very communal sort of space. That's the way I was always brought up watching films. But I wonder whether for reasons that are quite outside of our control, in many cases, we may not return to a primarily cinema-based experience for devouring new films.
Yeah, I suspect that will be the case, particularly because films are being released directly to like HBO or Prime or whatever, and people just become more familiar, I think, with just watching new releases at home, and that will affect my research, and I think it will affect a lot of research on transcendence in film, because of the whole like immersion kind of piece of it and collective experience kind of piece of it. So it'll be interesting to like revisit those works in light of a different sort of mass experience, right? Like I used to I don't do it now because it's a bit of a pain, but I used to watch things with my friend where we would hit play at like the same time and then try to it doesn't really work that well. I think there's some program that can help you do that now though. But I wonder if people are still going to be so invested in the communal nature of film watching that things will pop up like apps to watch things together. And if so, that will say a lot about the importance of the communal nature of it and what it means to people. So I'm very curious to see how this develops and what that means for film and religion research, given the emphasis on the communal nature.
No, I completely agree. I think in my case, I tend to go to the cinema on my own, but then I feel this urge to share the experience of writing a review, engaging with other people about it afterwards. So it's interesting that it's almost as though, the price I pay for going on my own, which actually affords me wonderful freedom because I'll watch, anything and everything. So it's not a case of somebody saying, often I'll say to someone, oh, I'm really looking forward to seeing this film. And they say, oh, I don't like that genre. I don't like horror, or I don't like romantic comedies. And you think that's fine. But, if you were really, set on watching something, then you'll compromise and watch something else. But because a lot of what I do is more professional, then in that regard, it matters a lot to me that I can just watch what I want when I want. And then interestingly, though, that I have the urge to do the sort of thing that if you were watching with friends in the cinema, you would do anyway. You might go and have a coffee afterwards or have a beer, and then you would dissect the film. So in a way, social media allows you to do that. So it's just as though we're doing the same thing, but we're just doing it in new ways.
Yeah, but that's interesting too, right? Because you go to the cinema alone, but you still go to the cinema, so you're never really alone. Even if you don't have like the post-cinema coffee or beer date, you have this shared like or wow or tears or whatever or there's still like a collective something to it even 'cause I love I'm a weirdo. I love doing things alone. I like going to the cinema alone. I like eating alone, but like in public places, people look at me weird, but I just think it's great. Like I can just eat and not feel alone, but be alone with my thoughts to read or whatever. Going to plays is the best alone because you can get like these last minute tickets and save money, and I can still have a collective experience, but just sit quietly. And like it's just like a weird thing of being alone, but not that I think is really integral to the human experience. Like even living in a city, people like living in a city because of the hustle and bustle. But when you live in a city, you don't always know your neighbors, so you're alone. But it's comforting that there are neighbors, and there's just like something strange about people wanting to sometimes be truly alone in nature, but then alone and invisible, but in a crowd, and that's still having some different sort of effect that I think is just so central to the cinematic experience. Like you're not alone in that you're experiencing something with others, but you're alone in that you can reflect quietly if you like. I think who you're around makes a big difference. One of my friends, well, in a group chat, my friends and I talk about a lot of superhero things, and Batman versus Superman came up. And as you were aware from reading my work, I do not like it. And so I was like, oh yeah, that. And like not, I don't know, maybe I've just watched it too many times, so now it's fine, it's fine. But it's not my favorite. But one of my friends had it on like their top five superhero films of all times list. And I was like, I can understand thinking it's fine, but like top five of all time with like Batman versus really? And so I asked why. Not in an open way. I asked why, kind of in like a friendly mocking way, like, how could you think this is top five? And then he explained that he explained two things. First, that his experience watching it was when he was living in Israel, and he went to the cinema in Israel to watch his film, and it he had a great kind of effective experience. And then second, when he watched it at home, he watched a director's cut, which he says is a better film than the non-director's cut. But I think his experience in the cinema in Israel watching this film was so meaningful to him that it was good enough to do the director's cut, which he thoroughly enjoyed. So I do think it's really interesting the effect that those around you can have on whether you like a film or not, right?
Yeah, and it sounds as though, obviously, as you already covered earlier, a lot of these memories, a lot of experiences, sort of go back to childhood. But when you went into academia as an undergraduate, what was your subject area? What was the subject area of your first degree?
It changed partway through. So So it started with biology and history. And then, I don't know, like the school I went to was a King's University College at the University of Western Ontario. So the University of Western Ontario is quite large. King's is quite small. It's part of the campus, but not, it's its own thing. And one of their requirements is that you have to get so many credits in a variety of subject areas to graduate. So you can't just like pigeonhole yourself in your interest. And it's like it's a Catholic background school, so they make you do religious studies things. And so I just did some religious studies things, and my grades were the best in religious studies things. And then eventually I had noticed that I had more credits in religious studies than I had in either history or biology combined. And I was like, oh, okay. And so then I switched to religious studies, and I was thinking, like, career-wise, what can I do with this? And I was like, oh, I'll teach in a school, because in Ontario, the province where I live, there's like a Catholic school system and a public school system. Both are publicly funded, both are government funded. But there's just a Catholic system and a public system. And so I was like, oh, well, I guess I could teach like in a Catholic school. And I thought, well, I'll teach English rather than history, because in Ontario you only need one credit in history, no, 2 credits in history to graduate, but you need English throughout your whole high school. So I thought for getting a job it made more sense to do like a minor in English for teaching and an honors specialization in religious studies. So I did that, and then I applied to one teacher's college because I was like, ah, it's not going to take much to get in. And I was like kind of arrogant when I was younger. And for kicks, I applied to Queen's for like an MA. And I got into both, but Queen's gave me like a fair amount of funding, because every graduate student at Queen's is like fully funded. And so I was like, oh, well, that's like a free thing to do, and I can always do teachers college after that. So then that's how I got into academia, was just on a bit of a lark, actually. I thought it can't be harmful. I was like, this won't hurt. It's gotta help, because eventually to be like a principal, you need a master's. I was like, okay, I'll just do a master's, and then to reward myself for doing a master's, I went to England on vacation, and I met with Will, because I was using his work, but I didn't want to buy his book because it was expensive. And so I had emailed him. I was like, do you have like a PDF of your book or anything? And he was helpful. And so then we corresponded. When I went to England, I met with him and one of his students, Phil Bevan, who Simon Brown supervised. And then he's like, you should apply to do a PhD. And so I did. And so that's,
And that's
yeah.
how it worked out. And
Yeah.
has the experience changed your career plans? It sounds as though you had various thoughts about what you might do, but the more specialized you've become, has that made you rethink what you're going to possibly do from this point on?
I mean, ideally, I want to be a professor, right? That's the dream. But it's kind of weird to be like an adjunct prof during COVID-19, having no experience teaching online. So I don't really know how to go about it. I've been applying. So right now I'm just doing like a research assistant thing with an old prof, which has been helpful just to like to stay in it. But ideally, I'd like to be a prof. But I mean, if that doesn't work out, I'm okay with like the private sector. I want to research, and I want to like make an impact on people, because I've had really positive experiences with professors and teachers. Like, they've all kind of changed my life in really good ways, and I'm really grateful, and I want to do that for somebody. And when I was doing my master's, I was a TA for like the whole time, and so I ran like a little tutorial, and a couple of those students took it because they thought it'd be like an easy class, and they're like first year, second years, and then they ended up being religious studies majors, and they told me later, and then like my profs then who taught the actual class told me later too, and it just felt so good. I was like, oh, like I've ignited like an interest. Like I've never ignited an interest before. Like that feels great. And so I'd really like to do that, but It's a tough market, right? But
Well, no, it is. And I think during lockdown as well, it's completely changed, you know, everyone's sort of sense of security or stability. And of course, you were talking about imposter syndrome earlier, which is, I think, one of the most common words that's coming up across the interviews that I've done. Because when I started doing this podcast almost 3 years ago now, I somehow imagined that it just goes to show sometimes you don't know the people you think you know. I just imagine that people would say, oh, yes, I knew I'd go to university and I'd do this and I'd do that. And that would be a sort of, you know, an inevitable sort of trajectory. But in many cases, it was luck, happenstance, chance, fate, accident, and you know, not even the same subjects that, you know, anybody might have thought they'd end up doing. It's sort of, you know, they ended up in a different department. Maybe they did a master's and then did something a bit interdisciplinary and ended up getting a qualification in a completely different school or department. But in your case, I mean, is that very different from what anybody else in your family has done, for example? Were you a trailblazer in that regard?
Yeah, my family's pretty working class, and I'm proud of they're hardworking people and they're smart. I don't think they all understand why I've done this, but they're very, like, they're supportive, but they're confused, which I totally get. Cause like most of them are like mechanics. One has like a roofing business, like farmers. Yeah. Like construction workers. Like they're like, it's very, just very, very different. But like, also like when I was a kid, I was very different. So they always want me to play outside, and I would play outside. But like the son and I don't really get along. It gives me rashes and stuff. So I was like, I don't really like outside that much. So as a kid, I was like really rambunctious, and I was like ADD and stuff. And I always want to be outside, but sometimes I didn't. When they were outside, I would want to be inside. And I did really weird things. Like I would read books, but I'm like a bit of a slow reader. So what I would end up doing is I would just like type out books. Like I found this typewriter and I would just type out books that I was reading when I was like 10. It was such like a weird thing. And so I think they knew I've always liked books, and like my grandmother was a librarian, and she like partially raised me, so maybe that's what it is. But like, yeah, I think they're all very different from me, and none of them really understand what I'm doing, but they're all very supportive. So it's actually quite sweet, because like I'm like,
no, that's actually a really, really lovely story, because what it shows is that sometimes at a young age, and I think this was Martin Scorsese's experience as well, that, you know, for health reasons, going out and playing wasn't something he was quite as a child, I think he was ill quite a lot. And of course, he wasn't able to play sports outside like a lot of his peers. So, of course, the love of film is something that sort of came about really because he was not able to do the things that a lot of his peers could do. But then if you can get over, and I think it was happened in my case as well, because I was not remotely sporty, and yet often the people, you know, the really cool people and the successful people at school are often the ones who are really good at sports. And so if you can sometimes just say to yourself, you know, if I can just see through something because it really matters to you, you don't want to just do what somebody else is doing because it feels like the real sort of like cool thing to do, then suddenly afterwards you can say, gosh, you know, having done that, you can set your own agenda, and there's nothing more satisfying than being able to sort of do something which is trailblazing. And it might be different from what anybody else has done. I mean, in my family, there are my sister and I were first generation university, and in that sense there was no template, no precedent for what we had. She's also works in the university in the UK, but actually she's based very close to Kingstone at Roehampton. So it's a very interesting sort of like path or journey that people tend to make. And sometimes the difference is that you can then say that you have ownership of what it is that you're studying, that you've got a certain degree of, you know, enlightenment almost of sorts that, you know, you've earned, and then there's no going back. So it's quite kind of exciting to be able to have got to a certain point that you may not have anticipated it. Nobody else expected you to get to the point where you are now, but you're able to say whatever you do in the future, there's a certain integrity and an authenticity to it because you're going to follow through on that dream. Would you say that kind of fits with where you feel you are at the moment?
Yeah, I partially, absolutely. I think it gives that narrative gives me a bit too much credit though, but yeah, like in some ways for sure, but in other ways people kind of not to say I didn't do it, but people have kind of carried me through a little bit, right? Like if Will and Kathy didn't intervene, I wouldn't have restarted. Like, I would have been so, I wouldn't have done it. And like, you know, my family had to make a few sacrifices to help me along, and like, it, particularly with that injury. And so I think, and my husband, and this is a, I don't know if we want to get into this, but this is very much, if it weren't for my husband, I wouldn't have been able to financially do a PhD. And that's just unfortunately true for like so many people that, I don't want to get too political, but I feel like just not, getting a PhD is a privileged thing. It just is. It's like a costly thing for both, limited, like you can't really do a full career and do a PhD because your interests are divided, but it's also like an opportunity cost thing and things like that. So I find in order to do it, it would be difficult to be truly working class and single to do it. So often I find people tend to be like middle class or have like some sort of support. So like my husband has like a great job, and because of him, I could do it. But there are probably people who are far more qualified than me who just can't do it because of that problem. So part of it, like the narrative you spelled out, like, yes, there's like an integrity to it. And I, you know, forged my own path and all these things. But I didn't do any of that alone. It was like people supporting me and helping me. Like I chose the path, but people carried me along the path I chose when I wouldn't have been able to do it on my own. And so I'm grateful for that. But it also makes me sad for some students, because I would love to be able to tell any student, like, for sure, you can do a PhD. But if they have to support their family, then can they?
Like, and that's happened, yeah, so many times. Somebody has come to me with a great proposal and that they've been really keen to do the PhD. But then often at the last minute, they'll just say, I want to do it, but I have this job. The PhD is going to take X number of years. Often there's a geographical issue that they, I mean, obviously now things since lockdown, it's become more possible to have sort of online teaching. But you know, even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even the norm was if you were doing a PhD, you were on the campus, not just in the same country, but on the same campus as your supervisor. And you'd meet him or her every 2 weeks or whatever it might be. And you'd submit work and you'd sit down with them and get feedback. And it's interesting because the number of times somebody would say, I want to do this, it's been my life journey, but I've got a family to support, I've got a job, and I haven't got the quote indulgence to sort of take that sort of time out. And it is sad. And I mean, I was lucky that I was in my early 20s at the time. And if I hadn't done it straight after my master's, you know, realistically, there's the question as to whether it would have happened at all. And I realized just how lucky and privileged I was and how hard it is. I mean, many of my PhD students have been much older, but it's a struggle. And in many cases, they're having to hold down a job, a full-time job in many cases, while doing the PhD. And of course, along the way, the question must arise, you know, was this the right decision? Is you know, and obviously there's always a point of no return when you say, you know, I've got to finish this now. I've done so much of it. Yeah. But there are periods along the way when you have your crisis of faith.
And I honestly, I think part of the institutions, and you and John Lydon talked about this a little bit, but part of the institution's resistance to like studying popular culture is this sort of highbrow thing. And I think there'd be less resistance and less of like a tendency to be like, oh, it must be university stuff, it must be highbrow stuff, if there was more diversity in graduate departments. And I think like financial help can make more diversity possible, which would introduce more ideas and just make everything kind of better, right? Because like, I know myself, like, I remember how I felt just that first week of my master's when I didn't know who Iliadi was. Like, I didn't know who he was. And like, everybody else knew who he was. And I was like, am I supposed, and it was, and I was just like, oh, I for sure don't belong here. And all these other people, they had like, very different families than I did and everything. And that's me as like a white person. Like imagine like, oh man, with no language barrier. That's me as like a white person with no cultural experience difference or language barrier or whatever. So I think that part of the resistance of the academy to more broader topics of study is very much related to like who we let in, because of barriers that we put up.
And sometimes it's so hard to sort of chart that course and see how did we end up where we are now based on, you know, I mean, along the way, there are always going to be, it's easy to look back, isn't it? And say, you know, I got to where I am now, therefore, you know, it was destiny. But in reality, you know that it can go one of, you know, a number of different ways. And, mm-hmm. And it does feel, and I think you have to remember those routes, and I do. And one of the things that one of the most enjoyable jobs I ever did, and I did it for, I think, for 7 years until only a year or two ago, was to be a senior tutor. So I was dealing with students' personal pastoral problems. And that was important for the very simple reason that the idea that, you know, you're just left to get on with something, you know, a university should always and is, you know, obviously grateful to have its students, but obviously the students need support. And for me, it was a real privilege because I was dealing with real people. My research often felt a bit more synthetic because it was wonderful to read lots of books and journals and film reviews and engage with those. But also important though that was, and necessary to know how to put all the different pieces of the thesis jigsaw, if you like, together, dealing with quote real people, I think was something that was important, because otherwise what you will just find is people will say, well, without that kind of a steer and that kind of support, what is the point in carrying on? You need someone to say, you know, I believe in you. And when you say to somebody, I believe in you, and you give them feedback, good constructive feedback, then often, you know, I've had students come to me years later and say, if it hadn't been for that conversation, you know, they may not have carried on. And at the time, you know, I wasn't aware that I was sort of dispensing great sort of like magical or wise advice. In a way, on one level, I was doing my job. But obviously, I believed in what I said, and I followed it through, and made sure that, you know, the students, you know, that they came back, and there were subsequent, you know, follow up meetings and so on. So it does make a big difference. But in your case, Christine, you know, obviously looking back on being at university in Canada and in the UK, I mean, what about things like teachers who inspired you and other great things and great experiences that happened when you were at university that you look back on and think, I was there?
Yeah, so many. Like university really changed my life forever. Well, and you know, sometimes people will ask, like, if you don't get a job straight after university, is it worth it? And the answer I always give is like, absolutely, absolutely. Because it just challenges you. So like, I completely it was tough. Like I felt challenged all the time. Because of the subject matter being like, I didn't grow up Christian, I became Christian. And so I did like religious studies, and I interrogated my own faith and other faiths. And it was really important to work through that, because I didn't want to believe something because of where I was born or like the people I encountered. I wanted to really understand it and make sure. So teachers were really helpful in challenging me through that, and also encouraging me that I could do things, you know, what I, like, and including like high school teachers and elementary school teachers. Like I had like ADHD in like the 90s, and my family was like, we're not putting her on Ritalin. And that was like unheard of. And so my teachers really had to work, you know, like I was allowed to go for walks. I was allowed to sit like on a bouncy ball, and they really like worked. I had great grades, but I only had great grades because these teachers were like, okay, we have to figure out a way to make school tolerable for her and people like her. And then in university as well, like there's this one teacher, and I remember people, he's like, would you guys prefer to have a break or leave early from this like 3-hour lecture? And everybody said leave early, and I was just like, there's no way I can pay attention for 2.5 hours. Like, what am I gonna do? And I just approached him, and he like saved his lecture notes for me. Like I attended class, but he like let me see his lecture notes to like help. And so every teacher I've ever met has just been so supportive and so encouraging, and really believed in me and challenged me. And they've all changed my, like all of them. Like I think I'm really fortunate. I haven't had a bad experience at all, which is why I want to be a professor so bad, because they've all been like so great. And you know, that bar conversation, I said, like, I can study comics. Like that's insane. And like, you can teach, that's insane. And like, you can do a PhD, or, you know, like it's just all been really great. Like Kathy, my second supervisor, she retired and kept supervising me after she retired. Like, they've all had such a crazy impact on my life, where it's just amazing.
Yeah, and you're right, because it's where academia is vocational. I mean, there are lots of other professions where that's the case. That's why filmmakers or politicians often don't stop. You know, you'll still have Clint Eastwood, you know, making films in into his 90s. And I think if you really believe in something, then you don't sort of think, oh, at a certain age, I'm just going to stop. I mean, that doesn't happen, at least not by choice anyway. But I was just thinking, sort of drawing together, Christine, a lot of the strands that we've been covering so far, because at this point in the interview, I normally ask more philosophically sort of based questions. But would you say that your memories, as you look back on your life and career, are predominantly positive ones?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like even the things that, you know, sound negative, don't feel negative when I think about them. And it's not like looking back with rose-covered glasses. Like, that's not... I think that a lot of personal development happens in trial trial is a strong word, not trial. I don't know. A weaker word than trial. And I think that the importance of people becomes clear during that. And so my whole academic journey, like switching subjects so often, moving countries, interacting with people. And I've gotten to do cool things, right? Like I got to do the Cinema Journal thing, like assistant editor for like 5 years, and read a bunch of stuff that I probably wouldn't have read otherwise. I've gotten to be a keynote speaker in Brazil. Like there's been like all these like really, it's all been like not easy, but like positive for sure. Yeah.
Wow. And you actually went to physically to Brazil.
Yeah, it was great. I got to go for like a week. And it was like this random LinkedIn message because somebody had read something I wrote and was like, would you be a keynote speaker at this at our conference? And I just had to do like an opening address thing and then like a roundtable talk. And then they published both the things. And it was on religion and secularity, which is something I like to think about a lot. So it's nice to talk about. And comics. And it was cool. And I was out of my league. Like the next year, their keynote speaker was like Trina Robbins. And she's like this like hero comics person. And I was like, okay, well, yeah, so many positive things came out of my academic journey. I hope it continues to be.
Absolutely. No. Well, the energy that, you know, is palpable from what you're conveying. But I suppose the flip side of that is when things are not so good. I mean, negative experiences. I mean, you've already highlighted the horrible account of what happened in China. But can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
Yeah, for sure. I look back at that China thing and it was not great. But I can be nostalgic about it because I can think of how it changed me and how people rallied around me to help. And I can feel quite nostalgic about their support. You know what I mean? And I can be nostalgic about the fragility of life and plants and how I discovered that fragility then. And I can be nostalgic about that growth. So I think for sure, looking back on challenging experiences, you can be nostalgic about them. Like, I don't think pain or sadness is necessarily something to always be avoided. I think it can be a positive thing to look back on eventually.
Yeah, and it's also something you touched on, I think, in the thesis in terms of happy endings and escapism and superhero narratives and the ending and the disjunction between the ending sometimes and everything that's come before it and, you know, situating that within the discourse of transcendence. So in a funny way, I guess that the tropes in superhero movies do sort of play out in it to varying degrees, at any rate, in each of our lives.
Have you seen the show The Good Place?
No, so many people have recommended it to me.
Okay, so watch, it's good. But there's this one line in it where one of the main characters says that part of being human is being aware that everything will end shortly, that you will die. And so part of being human is existing with this constant tinge of sadness. And so I think when we talk about transcendence, it has to touch us at where we're human to be effective, right? Like when you think, like transcendence is one of those things that's hard to define, but it's one of the things that I think very few people would contest about what transcendence is that it is not surface level and that it touches something deeper. And I think in the Good Place, you know, says this, I think one of the things that makes us human is a touch of sadness and a touch of uncertainty and a touch of like finality. And so I think that films that manage to to grapple with that in an authentic way can be have a lot more transcendent potential than things that wrap everything up neatly.
What would you think? What do you think your younger self would think about what you're doing now? Because you mentioned obviously that you didn't follow the same path that maybe other people in your family did. But you know, have you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young?
I wanted to be a lot. I wanted to be a marine biologist, but that means moving to BC, and there are too many bears. So, and I wanted to be an archaeologist. I think my younger self would be like confused. But still, like, okay, like I can kind of see how this worked out. But I think she would be like confused, like how.
Yeah, and are you somebody who keeps like a diary? Do you keep a record? Have you ever sort of had a way of, you know, documenting different periods of your life?
I used to, but then I never read them, and so I was like, I don't want to do that anymore. Because I feel like I should do it, though. Everything says that it's better to do it. And I go through phases for like a couple years, I'll do it. And I'll be like, I never read these anyway. And then I'll stop doing it. And then a couple years, I'll do it again. And I find I return to doing it when I need to feel grounded. So maybe there's like some sort of like cathartic thing. But when I don't need to feel grounded, I think I get a little bit arrogant. I'm like, I don't need this thing that I'm doing. Time waster, and then later I come back. So
see, I think you've hit the nail on the head, because I've kept a diary since I was 9 years of age, and I'm thinking, you know, who do I write it for? And I'm not even sure it's for me. Am I writing it for a future generation? Is it for posterity? It's interesting, because I often draw on those diaries and I go back over them, and often it's a good corrective against things that, you know, if somebody's, you know, on a superficial level, if somebody claims that something happened and you're not sure that it did, or you don't recognize the narrative, then the diary can be a way of saying, well, you know, on that occasion I was here, not there, and here's the evidence. But it is interesting, isn't it? Because I think all the way through life, sometimes there's always that sort of need sometimes, and you do it. I mean, research can follow that same sort of route as well, or a film review can do the same thing. It's sort of situating yourself. It's putting yourself autobiographically into a particular milieu, and being able to say, I feel comfortable with this. I own this. You know, I've written it. So it's your narrative, not somebody else's, that you're able to harness.
Yeah. I think that's a main benefit of it. And I think the fact that you revisit probably brings the benefit more. But I don't know if I'm just like uncomfortable revisiting. Maybe I don't really think about it, but I never revisit them ever. And so I wonder why that is, actually, but maybe I'll figure it out.
No, yeah. Well, it's the same. I guess I know people, though, who filmmakers do the same. I know Woody Allen and others say that once they make the film, they never watch them again. And I know people who've written like PhDs in some cases, and they say, I've done it. I never want to look at it again. Or in some cases, I had an undergraduate friend who, as soon as she got her degree, she got a very good degree in theology. And what did she do? She burned all her books. She said, I've got no need for them anymore. And for me, that's like sacrilegious. But, you know, we all have our different ways of you know, I still draw on my notes from my undergraduate days to varying degrees, even all these decades on.
I think I draw my idea book. Like, I have a little idea book, and I write little ideas, and some of them are like absolute crap, but some of them are still all right. I'm like, all right, maybe that's all right. But they tend to be like arm's length from me. And I think there's like some sort of, I think it's probably a credit to people like yourself who revisit their diaries, that it requires a certain level of comfort with who you are to be able to see who you were and be like, you know, okay, like that's what I did then. And that's what formed me or whatever. So I think it's probably beneficial, but I think that it's got, do you ever feel like uncomfortable reading?
Yeah. Well, yes, because what I think one of the things that I find is that the busier I am, or the more difficult things might be in my life, the more I write. Now that's paradoxical, because you'd think, well, if things are really tough or you're very busy, well, surely you can't write more than a few lines. It's when I was younger, sometimes, you know, I'd write a diary, but there might just be a couple of lines here or there, or it'd be very short, and I'd leave out lots of things. So in a funny way, it's about filling in those gaps. I'm interested, you know, sometimes the diaries are good at telling you you know, absurd details like how much, you know, a meal cost or what you had for dinner, you know, 35 years ago or something like that. It's just nonsense information. But it's not that, you know, all those years later, that's actually really interesting because it says something about the type of food that you eat, the places that you go. Those places may not exist anymore. You know, the particular cafes or restaurants or the people that you had those meals with, you may not be in the same company with anymore. So in a funny way, that sort of information, the stuff that seems incidental or even just daft at the time, all those years later on takes on a whole new meaning. And I think that is why that I sustain the diary, because you never quite know how to go back over and revisit that sort of material. But you are right, some of it is deeply embarrassing. Some of my early diaries when I was at school, when I was in my early teens, would often be like, you know, school holidays, and I'd be watching, you know, soap operas, like, you know, Neighbours would be the big, you know, Australian soap opera that would be shown on BBC TV at lunchtimes. And often in my diary would consist of effectively a plot synopsis of that day's episode. It's very interesting to read, but, you know, I'm reading it thinking, God, you know, did I just watch the TV all day and actually write a synopsis of that particular, or cartoon sometimes in some cases. So yeah, but also look back and think, but that was my 13-year-old self, so maybe I can get away with it.
That's really sweet though, to be able to do that, right? And I don't know, do you have children?
I do, yeah, my eldest is 9.
They might read it eventually. Like when my grandmother died, I went through her stuff and I learned more about her going through her stuff than, even though I like was raised by her, I learned more about who she was going through her stuff after her death than like before, and particularly like letters that she had saved from her father when he was fighting in the war, and just like small things like what you said about what he ate, yeah, or something, and how she felt about that. Like it'd probably be very valuable to them one day.
Yeah, I think for sociologists or anthropologists in the future, it's probably going to be an interesting sort of record of the sort of things that people did growing up in the 80s or 90s, whatever it was, in a certain part of the world.
They're going to read your synopses of the soap opera and be like, oh, okay, this is an interesting time.
Well, but also interesting to have a synopsis as written by a 13-year-old. So that's what, yeah, the 13-year-old got from it. So which is not necessarily the official synopsis that you'd get, say, in the Radio Times. And that's what makes it more interesting. It's a slant. And I suppose it's no different now to what I would do, obviously, all these decades on with film reviews. But it's picking the pieces that really matter. You know, that if I wrote a film review at the age of 9, it would be very different to what I'd write now, but it would be just as meaningful or authentic because it would be what I got from the film at that particular period of my life.
Yeah, that's very true. It's very, and look, it's like prophetic almost. You were writing film reviews early on and now you do it again. So kind of cool.
There is a consistency of narrative. There we are. Yeah. Certainly, when we're looking at it. Just a couple more questions, Christine. Are you in touch with friends from your past?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of sometimes I think about this. I'm like, do I just not like making new friends? But a lot of my friends I've had for like 15 plus years. So like my closest friends have been like around for like a really long time. I have some newer friends too. But yeah, most of my friends are old friends, even from the UK when I lived there. Like I still talk to people. I'm okay at keeping in touch. So I have lots of old friends from my past, and I think it's been interesting to grow together, you know, and change together and see where everybody ends up. Particularly when I think of like my friends from undergraduate, from like my undergraduate degree. Like we had this one professor, Julius K. Cato, and I'm his RA now. But I remember we were like his first class, like he was like a fresh face, and he just like took some of us under his wing, and almost all of us that he took under his wing have like done PhDs now, and like that's crazy to me, you know what I mean? Like none of us had planned on it, and we all just kind of did, which is interesting, yeah. And yeah. It's just fun to see how people grow together, yeah.
My very last question, Christine, okay. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Neither. I find if I look back too often or for too long, I become too nostalgic and it prevents me from looking forward. And I found, and my husband and I are really different in this regard. He very much looks forward, and he, like you, has had a very consistent narrative, like straight line directly to his goal. And like, it's been great for him, but mine has been really like windy. And so I find looking forward a little bit counterproductive for me, because like it's never worked out the way I expect. It's always been great, but it's never looked out the way I expect. And so I've been really, this sounds like so my generation, but I've been really working on like being like present in like the moment and not looking back or looking forward too much. Like I do a little bit of both, but primarily I have been trying to live for the day because there's no guarantee of tomorrow. And looking back, I can look back and during this talk I have, and I can look back quite fondly, but then sometimes if I spend too much doing that, it prevents me from enjoying where I'm at now.
That's a wonderfully reflective answer, and also quite hopeful in many ways, because it also means that although you don't know what the future has in store, you've got enough of a template to be fairly confident that actually it may well work out exactly as it should.
It always has. So it's been just, that's life. It always works out in some way. For me anyway, I've been lucky. But yes, so I've been trying to be more present. Because like, you know, so often people look back and be like, oh, those are the best times of my life. It's like, but did you enjoy them as the best times of your life, like while they were happening?
Christine, this has been such a treat. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for everything. I really appreciate you and your impact on my work and my life in a way.